So, is everybody comfortable? We're expecting that since there's still quite a lot of people registering, we're probably going to have people streaming in throughout, but we're going to get started anyhow. My name is Adabu Jeffwa. I'm the chair for this session, so I'll be facilitating the discussion, keeping time, and afterwards I'll be sort of facilitating the discussion amongst the audience. I'll start first with just a couple announcements. So first is COVID related. All socialism conference attendees are required to wear masks, fully covering the nose and mouth while indoors in conference spaces, and as well as the hallways and meeting rooms. Speakers from the front session may remove their masks in order to deliver their presentations, but only while actively speaking, and you have to put your mask on once you're finished. And audience members are still required to wear masks even while asking questions or making comments. The mask policy is in place to protect all of us, especially the immunocompromised, from the risk of contracting COVID-19. Second announcement is about the conference community safety plan. This relies in part on badge checkers, who you'll find at the doors of each room, and all attendees are expected to wear their conference badges at all times to enter conference meeting rooms. Please respect this rule, please respect the badge checkers, and know they are here to support a safe conference. If you have any problems or questions about that, please talk to somebody at registration. So once again, I want to thank you all for being here. This is fantastic to see all your faces. You are here in the room, and this is the Environmental Injustices of American Capitalism panel discussion. I have with me here Daniel Faber, Linda Kikiewicz, and Lee Brownhill of the journal Capitalism, Nature, and Socialism. So, it's my great pleasure to be here. We do have some attendees who require translation services, so please don't be annoyed if you hear people talking quietly amongst themselves while the panel is going on. They're probably just receiving the support that they need. I'll just mention for Daniel, Linda, and Lee, you each have 10 minutes to speak. Like I said, you're allowed to take off your mask. Please put it back on when you're finished. And then we will be flowing into a 45-minute audience discussion, which can include questions for the speakers, but we're hoping that it's predominantly time allocated for collective discussion amongst the audience. So, yes, on that note, I think I'll just leave the floor to you folks.
Thank you very much. Glad to see you here on this beautiful afternoon in Chicago. Thank you for giving your time to be here. I have 10 minutes to explain to you the anti-ecological dynamics of global capitalism and to explain to you how we move forward. So I will speak fast. But a couple things more about myself. I wear many hats, so in addition to being a co-founder and a co-editor-in-chief with Lee of the journal Capitalism, Nature, and Socialism, I'm also on the board of Coming Clean, which is a coalition of about 300 different organizations ranging from Greenpeace to Environmental Justice Health Alliance. We help make strategy for the movement on the left behind the scenes and channel resources to grassroots organizations. Also a co-founder with the Global Center for Climate Justice. I serve as the research director. And also I'm the director of the Northeastern Environmental Justice Research Collaborative and have worked with the leadership of the EJ movement in the United States for the last 30 years around a host of different issues. So the first thing, I would make a couple of propositions. The first is that for those of us engaged in movement politics right now, the environmental movement is facing a tremendous paradox. And this paradox is, on the one hand, in the post-World War II period, the environmental movement has emerged as perhaps one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, social movement in the United States. Some 19 million Americans belong to environmental organizations, and you know, if you look at the so-called environmental decade, over 19 major statutes were passed. So at many important battles have been won over the preceding decades, but one could say that despite these victories, the movement is losing the war. The ecological crisis is continuing to deepen. We now see that climate change is beginning to feed upon itself and accelerate dramatically as these feedback mechanisms are kicking in. We have a chemicalization of our everyday environment where billions of pounds of toxic waste are released into the American environment, enough hazardous waste each and every day to fill Wrigley Field from top to bottom five times over. As a result, because of this chemicalization of our everyday environment, we have a cancer epidemic in this country. More children die of cancer now than any other time in U.S. history, more of this disease than any other disease for the first time in U.S. history. One out of every two men in this room, one out of every three women in this room will get cancer during their lifetime. So we can speak now of a crisis of environmentalism and a crisis of a liberal regime of environmental regulation because of its failure to attack corporate power has failed to halt a growing ecological crisis. And this crisis of the liberal regime of regulation has sponsored two political reactions. On the right, we see an effort by the most highly regulated sectors of American capital to embrace a new politics of neoliberalism, free market environmentalism, or in many cases, a direct assault on the environmental movement. So over the last 30 years, we've seen the formation of a very sophisticated network of think tanks and policy institutes, public relations firms, and so forth, that are devoted to convincing the American people that climate change is a hoax, that the environmental crisis is not real, and that we need to embrace free market principles to ensure prosperity for the American people. This is the most sophisticated propaganda campaign and most expensive propaganda campaign that's ever been sponsored in human history. Hundreds of billions of dollars committed to convincing us that the ecological crisis is not real. And behind this are the Koch brothers and the oil and gas industry, the other major corporate polluters, the railroad industry, the railroads, other industries that are tied deeply into the fossil fuel industry. We also have a critique that's being forged by the left. And for example, the environmental justice movement, which argues that, well, environmental policy unintentionally has served to displace ecological crises onto people who have less political economic power to resist. So while we can no longer dump toxic sewage sludge into the Atlantic Ocean if you live in New York City, if that toxic waste is now loaded up on 3,000 railroad cars each and every week and transported across the country to Sierra Blanca, Texas, and disposed in a Latino community where 80%, like Sierra Blanca, where 80% of the population lives below the poverty line, the source of the crisis hasn't been arrested. It's just changed form and has been transported from one part of the country to another and impacting one group of people over another. So the main point I would like to illustrate here is from a neo-Marxist political economic perspective or the employment of socialist political economic principles, we have this task, which is to explain what is it that leads capital or American corporations or global corporations in general to knowingly inflict harm upon the American people or the populations in their own country. And very simply put, from the perspective of capital, any investments that are made in pollution control technology do not contribute to increases in productivity, do not contribute to increases in profitability. They are considered to be what are called unproductive expenditures. And therefore, all things being given equal, or particularly if you're in a situation where it's a highly competitive marketplace, the imperative on behalf of capital is to, rather than absorb these costs, such as installing very expensive pollution control equipment in their operations, to displace this cost onto the general public or externalize these costs. They're called negative externalities. So that logic is driven by the profit imperative and the logic of economic efficiency. But how this is done is also determined not just by economic efficiency, but also political expediency. One of the most anti-social forms of behavior of American corporations is when they knowingly dump toxic waste in the community that are going to result in cancer and other types of health problems. No community is going to willingly accept such hazards, particularly if they know it's going to impact their health and that of their children. So capital adopts strategies which are not necessarily always the most economically efficient, but the most politically expedient. How can we dispose or externalize these social and ecological costs onto the general public in such a way that it minimizes political opposition, that offers the path of least resistance? So in the state of California, for example, the toxic waste industry in the state were having trouble getting communities to accept the building of incinerators throughout the state. And for good reason, because if you live near an incinerator, often if they're burning toxics, what you get out of the smokestacks are super toxics, like dioxins and mercuries and so forth. Extremely dangerous to live near an incinerator, so communities were not accepting this. So they commissioned Sorrell Associates to do a report for the state of California and the chemical industry to help them figure out a solution to this problem. And on page 51 of the report, they conclude, under no such circumstances such a facility be built within a 1 mile radius of a white middle class community because of the greater likelihood of encountering political opposition. Instead, you should target rural communities, communities where the offending facility is on one line of political jurisdiction and the affected population is on another, because it's harder to bring political action. Working class communities, they footnote communities of color. Catholic communities, because they're considered more conservative. Nowhere in the report does it talk about siting these facilities where they would minimize public health exposure to these dangerous chemicals. It's solely around the ability of a community to offer political opposition. After the report is issued, 17 incinerators are built in Southern California in the Los Angeles area. Every single one of them was located in a low-income community of color. 90% of the population in the impact zone were people of color around these 17 incinerators. And that's just one example of many and many. So the strategy increasingly over the last 30 years has been for capital to displace the ecological cost of production onto the least powerful communities, both within the United States, white working class communities, Latino communities, African-American communities, indigenous communities, and also on communities that lack political economic power outside of the United States, increasingly displace harm onto countries that lack the political economic power to resist the imposition of these harms. Almost every country in the world has signed on to the Basel, Stockholm treaties, and many others, the Rotterdam Treaty, which prohibit the dumping of toxic waste, electronic waste, some of the most dangerous chemicals and so forth, onto the global south. Almost every country in the world has signed onto those except for the United States. So it's becoming increasingly a strategy to displace such harm both domestically and internationally. As you remember, Lawrence Summers, the lead economist under President Clinton, and the Obama administration, one of the most important economic planners on behalf of American capital and the Democratic Party power structure, once stated as the chief economist of the World Bank that I always thought Africa was vastly underpolluted, that the United States should do what it can do to export more of these dirty factories and toxic waste to the people of Africa because it represents less cost to the global capitalist system. So, at this particular moment, that is why we see the rise of an environmental justice movement in the United States that is devoted to increasingly challenging the displacement of ecological harm into working class communities and communities of color. The last thing I would say is, as a result of this, we can speak of issues of environmental racism and class-based environmental inequalities becoming of crisis proportions, not only in the United States, but around the world. The final point I would say is that, however, the goal of the environmental justice movement is not to ensure that all people are polluted equally. Not a very good bumper sticker, and it's a hard slogan to galvanize people around. So the challenge that we face working in environmental justice circles, the challenge we face as ecological socialists is how can we invent a new type of politics, a more transformative environmental politics that goes to the root causes of the ecological crisis. It's not about distributing the harm more equitably per se, it's about preventing the harm from being produced in the first place. And the only way you can get there is through a socialist ecological politics. It requires a democratization of production. Last thing I'll say, in Europe, they're beginning to do this. In Europe, the burden is now placed on corporations to prove that a chemical is safe before it can be introduced into the marketplace. In the United States, the burden is placed upon the public to prove that a chemical is dangerous after it's been introduced into the marketplace, meaning we're all guinea pigs. So we can talk more about how we begin a multi-class, multi-racial, multinational movement which can unite people in a struggle around a more transformative environmental politics which addresses the root causes of the ecological crisis as grounded in the dynamics of capitalist accumulation and power. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Danny, for laying that groundwork for us. My name is Lee Brownhill. I am the co-editor-in-chief of the journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism. I'm also a part-time academic in Canada, although I grew up here in Massachusetts in the United States. I want to just begin with a definition of feminism as the recognition that women are exploited under capitalism both inside and especially outside of the waged workplace. And of course, the fight against that exploitation. Feminism is a fight against capitalist exploitation. And my socialist feminism also recognizes that women produce the most strategic commodity under capitalism, labor power. They produce it generationally, and they produce it on a daily basis. Some of these realities reflect in the politics, the divisive politics of today about banning abortion and banning and criminalizing gender nonconformity. How can you have a capitalist system reproducing labor of men and women if you can't tell who's a man or who's a woman? I mean, really. Eco-socialist ecofeminism extends this further to recognize that nature is equally exploited by capital. Capital is undermining the conditions of life on Earth. And like the fight back in feminism, that another world is not only possible, it's necessary, and that it's well on its way to being created through the concerted activism of generations of ordinary people from below. For me, my socialism is informed since the 1980s when I was a student at UMass Amherst by the work of the Trinidadian Pan-Africanist C.L.R. James. He emphasized the power of ordinary people to change the world. He urged socialists to study and understand resistance, not only to study and understand capital, but to understand resistance, to make it more effective in the fight against capital and in the fight for alternatives, to defend the commons and reinvent the commons. In his 1973 article, Call to the Seventh Pan-African Congress, James argued that there were three bases that he could see for increase and making more effective the solidarity and organizational power of Pan-Africanism in his analysis, but I think it applies on a wider scale. Three bases for solidarity he spoke of, that solidarity and alliances should be continental, speaking of the continent of Africa, and global, not national, national, too limited. International capital moves across borders. We can't stop at our borders. Secondly, that grassroots leadership, not elites, was the way to go. And thirdly, he quoted the Caribbean poet Derek Walcott, who said, "Women are a future that men must learn." 1973, 50 years ago, James was talking about grassroots women of the global South building global alliances. These perspectives have shaped my own activism and my scholarship for the last 30 years. I actually was invited and privileged to attend the 7th Pan-African Congress in Kampala, Uganda in 1994, where the very issues that James discussed in 73 in that call to the 7th Pan-African Congress were very rigorously debated and moved forward, especially in the pre-conference women's meeting, where women in the Pan-African movement called on women and people of good faith all over the world to help stand up with Africa against structural adjustment and the IMF. So one of the significant findings of my own scholarship in activism in studying resistance was to identify what I saw, and not saying I was the only one to see this, but two opposing sets of social relations characterizing the class struggle. One which I would call the keystone social relation that holds up the patriarchal capitalist hierarchy of labor power. I call it, and colleagues of mine call it, the capitalist male deal. Now don't be fooled, it doesn't only involve men. You can have female male dealers. You can have a woman owning Exxon and killing Africans with oil spills. You can have non-white, white nationalists. We have a multiracial neoliberalism, as much as we're fighting for a multiracial democracy, capital is fighting for its multiracial neoliberalism. So this keystone relationship, the capitalist male deal, is another word for it, more commonly heard is divide and rule, divide and conquer, or in the colonial period, indirect rule. Lord Lugard in the 1920s talking about how the British had to go in Africa or wherever they were in their colonial world, find either the leader who they could bribe, force into doing their bidding, indirect rule. And I'm just going to read briefly because I did write a book about my studies of resistance in the Kenyan case over the long 20th century. And I, in particular, looked at cycles of struggle where capital, the colonialists, kept imposing different kinds of male deals to channel resources out of the country. So the history of colonial and corporate ascendancy in Kenya is marked by the cementing of specific successive male deals between selected African men on the one hand and colonial and post-colonial capitalists on the other. The British made male deals first with traders in the 1870s, then with the chiefs that they appointed in the 1920s, and finally with export cash crop farmers in the 1960s. Each new deal was introduced as a mechanism for restructuring their corporate activity and to deal with the fact that the people were resisting the imposition. Capital had to keep reforming itself. So as they amalgamated and restructured their production and trade from above, they simultaneously required the reorganization of labor from below. Let me just finish that quote by saying that the new male deals, as they took place, generated new types of resistance. And that is the social relations of alliance solidarity and unity and diversity of the struggles in the struggles against exploitation and violence of all kinds. If we go back to James's points about grassroots, third world or majority world, women and global alliances, we can see something that looks very much like the best of the social movements of today. And if we look at what those grassroots, global South activists and their allies, all up and down the hierarchy of labor power, all races, all genders, all ethnicities, joining together with the grassroots women, global South women. When we look at what those women are actually seeking and demanding, it's not only human life, human dignity, but also the cessation of the destruction of the earth. It's land back. It's land, food, freedom. Capital uses its enclosures and alienation to divide us from each other and from the earth. Our resistance, our socialism is the strongest when we draw together what's been torn asunder, unite people, defend the planet, seek to regain control over our own labor and its products. When you think of C.L.R. James, his most famous book, Black Jacobins, about the Haitian Revolution, in 1804, captive Africans freed themselves, freed, you know, they took back the private property of the slave owner, the private property of their own being, and inspired the abolition movement that, well, we still haven't quite won yet today. But this right wing, but this the power of this unity keeps capital on its toes. The backlash, the right-wing backlash we see today is precisely the prickling, the realization by these male dealers, both the capitalists and those in the, I don't know what they call themselves, the 3%, reeling at the threats to their hegemony. They must seek division at all costs to keep capital going, and that should tell us something. We who are on the side of freedom, we who are on the side of solidarity, compassion, empathy, accountability, and transformation, that our solidarity with each other is not only good for us and good for our resistance, good for the building of alternatives, but it undermines the keystone social relation of capitalism. Without the male dealers, that 0.1% out there can't control the rest of us. So I want to bring that concept to you and let you do with it what you will. I look forward to discussion.
Thank you all for the invitation to be here, and thank you to my co-panelists and chair. I am a popular educator and I am a writer, and what I'm writing right now is a book on Palestine, and some of the comments from Danny and from Lee and here, this whole conference, I think that they can be relevant. And one that I think about is, Danny, when you mentioned the paradox that the environmentalist movement is in, where there's so much more awareness than had ever been before, and a lot of people galvanized, but the paradox is that what the movement is struggling for is actually getting worse. The situation is getting worse. And that's something that I see in Palestine quite a bit, in that the more awareness that has come about the Palestinian struggle over the last generation following the peace accords, the worse the situation has gotten on the ground. And so much of the Palestinian struggle, like the environmentalist movement, that story travels through institutions that are not very kind, let's just put it that way, to the planet, whether they are the international courts or the universities, right, or the corporate media. And I think that that could be something that we rethink, like, where are our narratives going? Where is our struggle traveling through? Because when we need to tell our story, when we want to tell our story in those institutions, we need to make our stories make sense to them. And a lot of the time, it defangs our struggles. And I want to focus on this question of capitalism, specifically with the question of nature and the environment. In the popular education work that I do at home in Oxnard, California, a lot of it has been about reading books out loud in parks or in living rooms or in gardens or bicycle shops so that we can understand them. The out loud reading part is for comprehension because there's so much trauma with education, with learning, with books. And so we try not to replicate school. And what we've done is we've read several books, and one of them was large sections of Capital Volume 1 out loud, stopping after each paragraph to say, hey, what do you think this means? It's a very difficult book if you've attempted it. And what we came out of that, particularly on the first part of Capital Volume 1, the section on the commodity, we could see, even though Marx himself didn't say, we can add and we build this question of the ravaging of the earth. When we study capital and the ways that it functions with the labor theory of value or the value theory of labor, however we describe it, where it is labor that produces value and that gets extracted from the boss, the capitalist, that's the surplus value extraction. We don't talk a lot about where so much other value came from, and so much work that happens in the world produces that value that goes unsaid and unquantified as such under capital, and all of that is through the earth. So when we think of, for example, this piece of paper came from a tree. I hope the workers, whoever made the paper itself, were compensated well for their time. But did anybody ask the tree what kind of compensation they would like in order to be cut down to be made into paper? Did anybody consider to ask the tree if the tree was willing to be part of this relationship the way that the wage worker gets asked? It's a consensual relation. This is a distinction between the wage worker and the enslaved, and also the wage worker and the unwage worker. If there is work that is done under capital, so much of our fights have been revolving around the waged worker. And as Lee's presentation pointed out, there is so much more that happens beyond the wage. Under capitalism, what is important is the extraction of profit. We might call that the extraction of others' energy or other power to be congealed for future use in terms of money. But what we don't talk about is where the rest of the work comes from. Bees do a lot of work, and under capital, they're not valued as such. They're not compensated. They're not asked if it's okay for us to eat their honey. They're not asked if they want to be part of the pollination of plants so that we could eat. So this is a huge distinction that we've pulled out that's really necessary for us to think about when we think about capitalism, nature, socialism. It's important to not discount the nature part. You know, if you make paper and I make pencils, for example, we can exchange paper and pencils according to the amount of time that it took for us to make that. But again, who's asking the tree? And how would we even compensate the tree? Because what is a tree? What even makes a tree? Do we compensate the soil microbes? Do we compensate the air, the wind for pollinating? Do we compensate water? Like, that's impossible to do. impossible to do under capitalism. And so what happens under capitalism is that there is a massive devalorization of the world. And it's understood that only humans create value, but asterisk on that, because it's only specific humans. It is not enslaved humans. It is not those that are closer to nature. It is not the unwaged housewife traditionally, or house partner traditionally, right, who reproduces you so that you can go to work, because the boss is always talking mess to you and hurting you, harming you in so many ways. You come back to work, and then there's your partner to rejuvenate you so that you can go back to work. So all of these things are externalized out to others. And so we need to be careful when we talk about capital, nature, socialism, that we're not just talking about capitalism and socialism, right? We are part of nature. We are nature. There has been, even before capitalism, a really big problem in a lot of European philosophy that separates the human from the non-human in a hierarchical way, where the human is superior to the non-human, and the non-human is there to be exploited and used as resource for the human. That existed way before capitalism. I mean, that's also the governing logic of patriarchy, which has existed way before capitalism, of the male on top and non-male below. And this whole relationship of competition, what capitalism does is it makes that real to our everyday lives. It expands it into our ways of being. It makes it math. It makes it scientific. It makes it so naturalized that we don't understand, or we're taught not to understand any other way. Thank you. I was checking for that. So I will just wrap up. I have 2 minutes. And these are just introductory remarks so that we can talk about these questions together. So that's why we're keeping it pretty short. I will put out there a metaphor that might be useful. And the metaphor in our organizing work is one offered by the Zapatistas recently in Chiapas. The metaphor of the capitalist hydra. They say that capitalism is a beast that grows many different heads. When we fight off one, another one sprouts. And usually that new one that sprouts is one of our own desires. It can even look like us. It can resemble us. It's there to disarm us, to neutralize us. Now, the hydra doesn't have to be that a domineering kind of metaphor. Under capitalism, that's exactly what it is. The hydra metaphor has been used in the Haitian Revolution in a really helpful way. Shout out to William C. Anderson, who pointed this out to me. Maroon Schott's writings, The Dragon and the Hydra, talks about in the Haitian Revolution, the dragon being the more armed military force, and the hydra being the everyday people's creation of the world, and how the dragon kind of ended up taking over the revolution. But in the hydra in that case was of the below, of the people. The hydra of capitalism is that beast of the above that extracts from the below, oppresses the below. It only exists like the master. It only exists because there's a slave. Once we flee, once we maroon out, once we exit the situation, if the master wants to remain the master is gonna come and get us. So we gotta be prepared. The way to do this in the most non-violent way is for everyone to stop wanting to be somebody's master. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you all, that was phenomenal. I'm gonna open the floor to the audience. You are all welcome to raise your hand if you would like to speak, and I'll pick whoever from the audience, and you're welcome to stand at the mic in the middle of this row so that people can hear you. and try to keep it at 3 minutes if you can. Questions or comments or whatever you'd like.
Hi, I'm Frank Ridgway, Cincinnati Socialist. I'd like to be the first from my organization to wish everybody greetings from the future Cincinnati Soviet Republic. Two questions. Perhaps widely separate questions, but maybe not so widely separate questions. We have seen a lot of writing lately on the so-called metabolic rift, which some of you alluded to in your speeches. In Capital Volume 1, lots of ink being spilt on that lately, and I adhere to that theory. I think we do need to focus on it more. But both Marx and Engels, whenever they write about the metabolic rift, and this is the part where I have to close my eyes, they also refer to abolishing the binary between the country and the city. And as a lifelong city boy, I have a hard time wrapping my head around that, even though it follows logically from the metabolic rift theory. So if we can maybe speculate a little bit on what that might mean, especially once we win and the great global October happens. That's my first question. Second question is, we heard some talk about the Global South, women in the Global South. Right now there's a big fight going on in Jujuy Province, Argentina. The fight has been carried on by mostly indigenous people, teachers, and God love them, Trotskyists. And we just saw people shot in the streets in Buenos Aires about 2 weeks ago, protesting in solidarity with people in Jujuy. That struggle is over lithium extraction. Most, even liberal people in the global north understand petroleum is bad, cattle is bad, forestry is bad. Some people think lithium is gonna save us. It's not saving us in Jujuy. So how do we address that struggle? I don't see a lot of left organizations addressing Jujuy, left voice being one. So how do we address that more, and especially at the level of praxis, how do we address it?
So folks up here are welcome to respond, and also anybody in the audience is welcome to respond, and I might just give the audience a chance to think on that before I give the floor back to either of you.
Hi, Alessandro from Olympia, Washington. I'm not here to jump in. I actually have another question. I guess since ideally when there's socialism, all the people of the world will work together to plan how we're going to develop and have a balance between human need within nature. But since we're not at that point right now, how do we address self-determination, especially from countries in the global south that are trying to get out of poverty, which is hard, which is almost impossible under capitalism, but look at extraction in order to do that. How do we find that balance between if a country decides that in order to get out of poverty that they need to do extraction, which is part of the thing that's killing the planet, but that's what they decide to do, whether or not that aligns with imperialism or not, like how do we find that balance and as we try to move forward to try to find alternatives so that people don't have to look at just extraction in order to try to eliminate poverty.
I'm Luigi, I'm from Argentina, I'm from Les Poblis, so I live in Jujuy, I was like, okay. Yeah, because my family lives to the south of that area. And I think something interesting on Jujuy is how labor and indigenous communities are working together, because there is always this notion of separation or how the other one could help to each other as they were separated things. Like a lot of indigenous people are also teachers at schools, and they also belong to unions. So this fight in common to defend the rights of the human access to these resources, etc. You know, it's also done by unions, strikes, shutting down routes, confronting the police. Like, this is a battle that shows all the antagonism and shows the role of US imperialism, because US is behind all these, sending arms, supporting the government, etc., against the people of South America. So I think it's a very example, very good example to think that work, that joint work. In Buenos Aires, there were protests in solidarity, and a person was killed just for not even shutting down the street, just being there talking. So how even from the city that is far from that place, the police is willing to shut down any kind of solidarity protest. So I think all this shows how all the fight is one, it's common. And a quick comment about the panels. I feel like it's not very expanded, but Marx talks about labor being the father and nature being the mother. There's a whole chapter that he writes about how profits and everything can also come from nature. And one of the problems of capitalism is have divided human from nature. Even when we think of ourselves, we are not thinking about nature. We think more as exploited people. And I feel like we are also forced to labor. I think it's not a free decision that we take. I work for UBS, I'm a warehouse worker, and you know, I have to go there to pay my bills. So I would love to choose a different work instead of the one that I have. So me being forced there, something that would be liberatory, that is the ability to work, the ability to be connected to nature, is totally destroyed. Like, we are treated as robots. Nobody cares about our health, our needs, and our psychology. So I feel like even inside labor, nature is destructive, because if we consider ourselves as part of nature, it's one of the worst characteristics of capitalism, how we are divided from our own being.
I like the Hydra metaphor, and I was curious, I went all in the metaphor and looked up how Hercules killed the Hydra, and apparently he took a torch to, like, it said cauter, which means like burn each wound so it doesn't regrow. What would this mean in this metaphor? If we like went further with the metaphor, what would it mean to cauter a severed head so it doesn't grow back?
Thank you for that. Just, you know, yes, Hercules killed the beast that way, except what gets left out a lot, it was his nephew that cautered the head, Ilios. And this is something that Zapatistas point out too as well, that the history usually is about the individual, but it didn't show that it was a collective effort. I don't know what it would mean to cauter it, but that is the great question for all of us in our different geographies, because the heads look different everywhere where we're at. The point is for us to figure out what can make it so that maybe instead of cautering, we might just destroy its habitat. What gives capitalism the habitat to continue living, to continue extracting? What gives it its fuel? And a lot of that is our own participation in it. in terms of cottering, it'd be a really great conversation to have, and I've never gotten asked that question before. So I'm gonna think about it a lot. Thank you for that.
I very much appreciate each of the presentations that you crammed so much, each of you, into 10 minutes or so. I appreciate that very much. I have a couple of just informational questions to Dan, and then a more general question for all of you. Dan, you said something that struck me. I'd like to get documentation on it. That is, that this is the most expensive propaganda campaign to deny the impact. Really? Holy cow, that's pretty impressive. I'd like documentation on that so that I can share that with others. And I liked the points that you made. You made a joke almost, you laughed, you know, in 10 minutes you're gonna do it. And then you did in 10 minutes, a very good, succinct, outline, and I'm wondering, is that in print somewhere where also that could be shared around? The more general question is this one, and it haunts me all the time. We've got maybe 20 years, max 30 years, to fix this, to solve this. We don't have all the time in the world. And it's not clear to me that we're going to be able to fix it or solve it. We may have all kinds of interesting discussions about what's happening to us and what it all means and so on. But unless we can change it, actually change it, we're dead. And so what thoughts do you have on what it's going to take to fix it, to change it? What's the strategy and the set of tactics that goes along with it that we can begin to mobilize around over the next 10 years to build something that within 20 years, we're already losing millions of people. We will lose all kinds of things, but do we have to lose everything as we philosophize about it? Or what kind of plan can we come up with? Thoughts on what kind of plan we can come up with practically?
There's a person with a blue mask that wanted to come up to the mic.
Thank you. I'll just keep it real brief. Liz Corrado, I'm based here in Chicago. I'm really interested in how we nurture the intersection between environmental justice and abolition, and ensure that we... In Illinois, I've seen how funds that are intended to combat environmental racism and environmental justice are actually going to greenwash prisons, police stations, etc. And I really want to explore this. So it's sort of a question for everybody, and also a please find me afterwards if this is something you're interested in too. So thanks.
I thought I saw a hand over here as well, with the blue hair, please come to the mic.
If you could incorporate it when you close or you answer the questions and the comments that have been said so far, the question of immigration. It's when we, I'm an old Marxist, I'm not a neo Marxist. So in our time, when I was young, we always talk about the historical subject of the revolution. And we always thought that it would be the proletariat. And things are very complicated when you say about this multi-class type of movement. And it's complicated for us, the old Marxists, to think on a multi-class type of movement. But at the same time, we're looking these 20 years that is coming, I mean, the situation is very serious. And at the same time, we have this divide between countries that put their garbage in other countries and other countries in self-determination, that they have that right of self-determination or wanted to make better economically, even if they contaminate their own soil. And then the workers that we want our salary because we need to survive. And even if, so those proletariat that are working in the more contaminating type of industry that deserve all the rights and all the benefits and that livelihood, destroying those contaminating entities is against their own livelihood. It's very crazy and complicated. I live in San Francisco and I work and live, I have make my family in the immigrant community of San Francisco. So I see those struggles all the time. The question of not having documentation in this country is so complicated, of not having rights, not having right to vote, having right to access many things, not being able to go back to your country and look at see your families, et cetera, et cetera. But then the global crisis in the environmental situation bringing thousands, maybe millions of people through the world in this movement of mass communities through the world. We have here the caravan that started from Central America so far, and then we have this encampment at the border. So all of this is happening at the same time, and I just can't remember, the 20 years is like here, very present. So in your response, when you respond to this, because what would you say about all of this? How we could put together a plan or a strategy of moving forward with all of these circumstances happening at the same time?
Back. And I'm just wondering if you have a question or if you have a response, because I think there's quite a number of questions that people are wanting to sort of hear a response to. It was not a question? All right, well, feel free to come up and share, and then I'll give the floor back to anybody who wants to respond to any of the questions that were asked.
There was a lot of questions. My name is Jen, and I'm here from Hamilton, Canada. And I am a teacher, and I am also a union organizer with the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario and a climate activist. And I think that it's really tough, actually, and really difficult to hear the stories that you're sharing because it's bleak, right? And the fellow at the back asked, what can we do about it? And I think it would be really great if we could share some stories of organizing. Like, how do we deal with this issue, this crisis that we're in, which is massive? And so I'm going to share just a couple things that I've done and learning that I've done from it. One is through my union, recently at our annual meeting, we had a motion passed to just have the union have a task force to bring forward recommendations about how we can deal with the climate crisis, which was great. But I mean, side note, that passed 292 to 282. Like, I mean, it was really extraordinarily frustrating because while we're very happy that that motion passed, it was by 10. It's like, aren't I in a room with 600 educators? But anyways, that's a side comment. Like, what is going on here? I mean, we can see that broadly in other areas of the world as well. The other thing that I've done in terms of organizing is I've just formed a small neighborhood group so that we can talk about some of the environmental issues that are going on locally as well. And I think that one thing that we see with the very, very serious situation that we are in on the planet is that a lot of people are struggling with getting organized. Like, we can kind of get ground down and not see the opportunities to connect with other people, to build community, to recognize the injustices that exist in the world that are creating this problem.
I'm going to try and give an answer that ties all those questions together. I think one of the things that a simple proposition would be the manner in which global neoliberal capitalism is creating an ecological crisis that cannot be resolved within the framework of a global capitalist system. We have some differences with Foster. they're small. I don't know if it's sufficiently dialectical. There's some issues with presented nature in a somewhat passive way, but I think those are small issues. We essentially do agree on the ways in which capitalism is destroying its own conditions of production. We call it the second contradiction of capitalism, which was articulated to some degree by Marx in Capital and elsewhere. But if you take externality theory and just apply it, what's happening on neoliberal capitalism? In order to increase their competitive advantage, every individual corporation is compelled to increasingly displace or externalize more and more harm onto environments and communities around the world. And as a result, it is creating ecological crisis, which is actually threatening the conditions of existence for capital and the capitalist system as a whole. So what is in the interest of individual corporations is contrary to the interest of capital as a whole. What is in the interest, short-term interest of capital is contrary to the long-term interest of capital. But since it's not a system of planned production, capital can't resolve this contradiction. It requires a strong state to regulate the behavior and protect these communities from the displacement of harm. And wherever democracy is weak, the capacity of the neoliberal state to protect the general public from the ravages of capital are incomplete. So, one of the primary functions of neoliberal globalization is to increase the rate at which nature is extracted from the global south in ever greater quantities at ever lower cost. This is called unequal ecological exchange, and however you want to measure it, one of the great successes of neoliberal capitalism over the last 30 years is finding ways to extract ever greater quantities of natural resource wealth from the global south. No matter how you want to define it, in terms of weight of minerals or the calories or the energy content, at ever lower prices. So global capitalism is in many ways, this is a new form of ecological exploitation of the global south, which is resulting in a profound ecological crises of the global south and the increased displacement of peoples from their traditional lands. And so one byproduct of that is climate refugees or ecological refugees to the global north. Nowhere in the public debates do we see this around immigration, the way US foreign policy has destroyed the ecological conditions in much of the global south, which necessitates people to immigrate into United States. So that would be number one and number two. There's many more other things I could say about this, but in terms of the data, it's about 91 different organizations that are funded by the oil and gas industry, the petrochemical industry, railroads, and so forth, that receive over $900 million a year in funding to convince the American people that climate change is not real and that the ecological crisis is non-existent. $900 million a year. These are the same organizations that, alarmed by growing mobilization on behalf of the American people, particularly by people of color in the environmental justice movement, challenging these new forms of extractivism and ecological crises, that are funding a massive campaign to restrict voting rights in the United States. And we've done this analysis, so there's a study that we put out, the Global Center for Climate Justice, that looks at the tens of millions of dollars that are being devoted by the fossil fuel industry to roll back voting rights in low-income communities, working class communities, and communities of color throughout the United States. So I think that's a very, very important connection and point to make, is that neoliberal capitalism, as the contradictions, the social, ecological, and economic contradictions associated with neoliberal capitalism become ever more profound, the threat that that poses is leading to the embracement of increasingly authoritarian measures. That as these contradictions are leading to ever more popular mobilizations, there's a recognition on part of corporate power structures that we can't allow democratic institutions to persist, and hence we need to embrace authoritarianism, begin insulating capital from these democratic institutions if we're to maintain business as usual. Right now, the fossil fuel industry sits on $100 trillion in known fossil fuel reserves. if they develop all those fossil fuel reserves, it will take us five times beyond what the scientific community says is safe. If they develop 100 to 120 trillion dollars in fossil fuel assets, by the end of the century, the world will be 11 degrees warmer. We'll be over 700 parts per million. The interest, the profit imperatives of the fossil fuel industry are completely incompatible with the needs of humanity and the future of this planet.
I'm just going to say to the person who said that, about the Hamilton teacher, who said that the vote was so close. I think it goes back to the idea that a lot of very educated people in the first world, in the minority world, dismiss, you know, any other, they buy the idea that there is no alternative. We have to have capitalism, we can't do anything else. All these peasants and indigenous people and anti-capitalists are just dreaming that we can't do anything else because look at how bad Stalin was. So I think that when I go back to the socialism from below, the C.L.R. Jamesian perspective on socialism that valorizes grassroots people over the elite, the leadership and the vision, not only the leadership and the vision, but they already have feet planted in that other world, either the world of the past, or struggling in the interstices between the commodified market and capitalism, living in that other world, which is more based on communality and collectivity. For instance, in Nairobi, Kenya, the poorest people in the markets will get together themselves. They're working at a market, but they're getting together themselves as workers and putting in money to send one of them to go buy wholesale. That's something self-organized within a capitalist market, but they're using the capitalist market to bring resources into their subsistence and collective commoning relationships. So that's happening among the people who are pushed aside and are on the edge, on the margins. They're on the margins of the capitalist economy, but they're also more firmly planted in the alternatives. So that's why I believe that Jamesian's vision and his advocacy for grassroots, women's, and not only women's, but women feminists. Men can be feminists. It just means, you know, respect for life and for the life-producing power of human beings. And not having your product ripped off from you, which is for us, our kids. And I want to address also, there was a Harvard professor, Ronald Seaboy, who wrote a book on subsistence economies, who said that the peasants of the world are just, you know, they value laziness, and that the best way for, you know, third world countries to develop is to invest in police forces and militaries to force people off the land and into commodified relationships. So that's the kind of, I mean, obviously he's not a socialist, but even the socialists are dismissing the value of a lot of socialists are dismissing the value and the vision and the power and the alternatives at the hands of the unwaged, the indigenous, the people way on the margins. That speaks a little bit to that idea of who is the object of the revolution. Is it the proletariat? You know? Well, not in James's view. It's a very different kind of protagonist. Then on the question of abolishing the binary between the city and the rural area, I'm not sure what the problem is. I would love that. I would love to see every street have a garden, every city block be half houses and buildings and half garden and wild area. Why not? it's been done in history before. There are ancient civilizations that are huge cities that also had huge amounts of food production going on in the city. I don't know that, I'm not sure what the objection was. Seems like a great idea to me. But that's because I love farmers. I love the soil. I love the bees. And I believe that the people who have their feet in the soil have a lot of power and resources that where they can leap out of the commodity relationship much easier than most of us who have to go to work at the UPS to pay our bills. And yes, I'll pass the mic. I wanted to address the self-determination, but I think I'll leave that.
I'll try to keep mine very brief. I have a lot of thoughts running from the great comments and questions. One of them, there was a, and very much connected, building off what you're talking about, Lee, there was a concern about, you know, what happens if, you know, countries decide themselves, you know, that this is, they want to go toward capitalism. I think that's how I understood the question. And what needs to be complicated is what a country is and who's deciding the we, because so much of it is a nation-state kind of framework that we're working on. But when we talk about questions of development, very rarely are people themselves asked what kind of development it is that they want. Instead, it is the administrators of capital, the nation-states, who decide on behalf of capital, what kind of development takes place. And so when we're thinking about this question too, about, you know, egalitarianism, because so much of the history of capitalism has been very clearly, a far clearer, let's say, Europe versus non-Europe, and in the 20th century that started to change with the United Nations and more inclusion and diversity. And just because though one is the wretched of the earth, or comes from that position of wretched of the earth, you know, as Franz Fanon called the below, that doesn't mean that you're automatically a revolutionary or that you're going to want something different. Most of the time, the only option we get under empire is to assimilate into it. That's it, if we want to survive. Which means that we need to keep crushing others, crushing ourselves, and becoming what they want us to be, what empire wants us to be. So I look very, with a lot of love and inspiration, to the writings of the Maroons, the fugitives, the enslaved Africans who ran away from the plantations over centuries and created new territories called Quilombos in Brazil, called Maroon societies here, together with indigenous peoples and European outcasts who wanted to run away too because they didn't want that world either, and how to create something new. And of course, the question is, how do we not recreate the monster that we're fighting? That's always the question for a social justice, ethical posture. Something that I think can help us find a lot of inspiration is the work that folks are doing on this question of the pluriverse. It's trying to understand better what a world where many worlds fit. What is that? What does that even look like? You know, it's a Zapatista call for many decades, where they talk about, instead of falling into this first world, second world from the so-called Cold War, which really was the Third World War, but the so-called Cold War, where we're all forced to choose either NATO or the USSR, how about we have a world where we can fit all of our worlds that we want and not have to assimilate into the first world or the second world or somebody else's world where there's global designs so that everyone can be the same? It's not very respectful at all. It's totalitarianism, it's the logic of capital that we're trying to fight. Something inspirational, if you want to look more into that, is the Pluriverse, a post-development dictionary, which talks a lot about the problems of the development model during the Third World War, where the United States took over the Europe of Britain.
as the imperial state, and instead of using the word colonialism, began using the word development for the same thing, but on behalf of capital. And yeah, very, very briefly on this question of working together with indigenous peoples, you know, workers and indigenous peoples, and also on this question of extractivism, I think about Bolivia a lot, sadly, how Evo Morales, an indigenous person who was put into power by the movements strategically so that he could support the movement, ended up co-opting the movement and destroying those that used to support him. And so then when, you know, the enemy was at the gates, the enemy's always at the gates, there isn't anyone there to support you anymore after you've co-opted or destroyed those who used to support you. And when we heard that that happened, the coup in Bolivia in 2018, when there was all of this conversation about lithium and about how the United States overthrew Evo Morales because he didn't want to sell them lithium. Okay, he wanted to sell lithium to China and Russia. And for some reason, that was not a problem. What was a problem was that he wanted to extract lithium. No, what was a problem was that he wouldn't sell to the United States. The problem wasn't that he's an extractivist president. So this is what I mean about beware of the capitalist hydra growing a face of our own desires. It disarms us in a serious way. What is it that we're really talking about? Are we talking about specific identities only? Are we talking about something bigger than each identity? Are we talking about new ways of relating to each other in the world? Are we talking about respecting difference rather than annihilating difference? You know, huge, huge metaphysical questions that we have. So check out the Pluriverse Dictionary, Post-Development Dictionary. It's got a lot of different keywords. It's really great for beginners and advanced on what the debates are, what the movements look like on the ground. One of the editors is Arturo Escobar, who was a professor of mine when I was in grad school, and he now has on the web for actual alternatives. He's part of this huge group all over the globe called the Global Tapestry of Alternatives. If you look them up, they can show you lots of other things that movements are doing around the world, trying to think of this, how do we share the world together?
Was an old poker buddy of mine, actually. Always took me for a lot of money. I think one of the questions we have now is, where do we go from here? And I think one of the most important things that we should do politically is that we need to hold up good examples, and we need to begin talk openly about how we build a counter-hegemonic politics in the United States and around the world in the face of a growing authoritarian capitalism. So it's very easy in the face of the ecological crisis to retreat in fear or despair. And it's very important for us to begin putting forth examples which can inspire one to take action. And right now there's a lot of federal money coming down the pipe. And we see, I think, some at the grassroots level throughout the United States, some very exciting developments. The Red New Deal, the land back movement among indigenous peoples, the increasing mobilization of the EJ movement to target resources for the rebuilding and restoration of low-income communities of color, the formation of a Green New Deal network in urban cities all across the United States at the Global Center for Climate Justice. We now see the formation of a sort of a leftist urban Green New Deal network in not only San Francisco, Los Angeles, Boston, and places like that, but also in Raleigh, North Carolina, in Kansas City. And so what we see in places like Los Angeles is the adoption of policies where we're going to, in Los Angeles, shift to electric buses. And working with the steel workers, we're going to build that plant in Los Angeles with union labor and new workers that we recruit from low-income communities of color that have been marginalized in the past from participation in the labor movement. In Boston, we have the beginnings of free public transportation. In other cities, and across the U.S., a decommodification of the city, making public access, public transportation, a right of citizenship rather than a commodity to be bought and sold. So this is where we should put our energies, where we can begin constructing these alternatives and these models, take advantage of the funding, and push it as far as we can and adopt socialist principles. Promote forms of renewable energy which don't reinforce the power of utilities, but rather are more public forms of ownership that give people actual control over their own energy resources, such as solar tops on their roofs, so that when they export surplus energy onto the grid, instead of paying the utility at the end of the month, the utility sends them the check. And that is a vision of how we can address the ecological crisis, which is actually improves the quality of life for people, around which they can become excited because it results in a greater freedom and prosperity for them. So that's our challenge, is to articulate what a socialist ecological politics could look like and to create that excitement and enthusiasm for becoming part of that movement. That's what the journal is devoted to doing, articulating these types of examples, both the United States and Europe, the Global South, and all over the world. And the work at organizations like the Global Center for Climate Justice is to begin serving as a catalyst for a sort of a counter-hegemonic, socialist-inspired ecological politics.
So we have about 7 minutes left, and if anybody has any closing words up here in terms of speakers or anybody else would like to share from the audience, sure. Okay, sounds good. I see a blue shirt and a peach shirt, so whoever wants to go.
Hi everyone, my name is Usama. I am here in Chicago. I'm a member of the French Green Party. I am an activist with them. I've been with them for more than 10 years now. I'm trying to leave this panel with kind of a positive note and an optimistic view, but unfortunately I can't. And it's actually, I have a lot of racing thought right now that I'm trying to jungle around. Hearing that we have only 20, 30 years left, trying to balance that with, community activism and organizing at the very local stage, and balancing what we said about the super profits from the fossil fuel industry and all of that, I kind of resign my feelings towards the fact that they will need a top-down approach to solve things in the time frame we have. Bottom-up is what we do, all of us here, community organizing and all of that, but that takes time. And with all due respect, electric buses in LA won't resolve the issue right now. It's not the time frame that we're looking for. And I'm trying just to gather your brain, and feel free to come talk to me. It's just, I feel like we need to go to the higher offices, the presidential offices, the higher politics, the national, and the little fate that was given to me a few months ago was the presidential election in Chile. I know that the current president in Chile is potentially a good one, or we could critique him, or but he made, like, that movement made it to the top at a big country. How can we do this here? How can we puzzle up all the different community organizing that we are doing at a local stage? We say think global, act local. Maybe we can think local and act global as well. And it goes both ways. So I was just trying to leave with some kind of, I have two young kids and I'm trying to see if we're gonna leave them a planet maybe they'll have free electric buses when they grow up, but maybe they'll have to deal with forest fires that will kill all of us at a certain point. So thank you.
It seems to me that a lot of the comments and questions present a real material conflict of interests, right? The suburbs that don't want the incinerators versus the low-income neighborhoods who end up getting them. Lithium mining in the South versus people who want electric cars here in the United States. I mean, it seems like, how do you bridge those real material interests? It's a huge question, and
you
there's
have
5 minutes left, so.
Thank you both for that. I agree about the situation in LA, which is where I'm at. In our podcast, in Capitalism, Nature, Socialism, we started a podcast recently, and we have just 4 episodes. I think it's the 4th episode where we talk about the Green New Deal in Los Angeles. And it's very interesting because you start seeing cities. It's a geographer whose name is Kelly Kay at UCLA. And what the point of the piece is how you see this conflicting scales of like the city being global, like LA is trying to kind of like create networks of power with other cities, particularly under the Trump era, that was really prominent of cities to do so that they could bypass the national. So they just went to the global, the way that the state is already global. What was really telling is that in that piece, the author revealed that LA's Green New Deal was drafted by PricewaterhouseCoopers, which is one of the accounting firms of Empire. And so when we think though about the state, the city and the nation state, both of those scales are working for capital, why are we looking to them for our solutions? I understand the urgency and just wanting a top down like we would like as stressed out parents with a child or someone like, you know, we want you to do this now, kind of bringing down some kind of authoritarian. I don't have any answer in terms of that, but for sure I'm more of a prefigurative politics kind of person, and I do not want to replicate again the monsters that we fight. And I think that we can do things more creatively. And I think something that's not being said is on this question, we really need to reconsider the ways that we live, our lifestyle. Like going to a conference, an anti-capitalist conference like this for me is very strange, that it's in a hotel, that you have to pay. You know, usually you just camp out and go to an encounter somewhere on the ground, or, you know, there's all kinds of ways that we do this all over the world. I go to Mexico a lot. We don't do it like this. You know, it's creating something out of nothing. And then that, in that process, it shows us that we can do things together. We can build huge, enormous, marvelous encounters, and not just encounters, but that can show us that we can build the world. And that changes you as a subject, as a person. And you start thinking about other ways. That this conference is in this kind of place, I think it's gonna prevent us from the question of our own lifestyle. And that has to be a huge question when we're talking about ecology and capitalism.
We'll take one last comment from the audience, and that will be our time for today.
Hi, I'm Camille Landry from Oklahoma City, and I'm glad I'm the last speaker. Please, my brothers and sisters and siblings, do not underestimate the value of staunch resistance, because the system that oppresses us and rapes the planet cannot, even if it were intending to, solve the problem. It can't bring liberation, it can't bring justice, and it can't bring climate justice. And so don't underestimate the value of resistance, of making it cost more. We didn't stop the pipeline, but we damn sure made them spend a few more million dollars of their money. You know, we didn't stop other kinds of infrastructure that are degrading the environment, but we made it cost more. And if those efforts were more widespread and more ferocious, we could do some damage, because we are literally in a war for our lives and the lives of all life on this planet. And you're not going to win it by singing Kumbaya.
Thank you to everyone who came, and I'm looking forward to seeing your faces throughout the weekend.
And if you're interested in the journal, Capitalism, Nature, Socialism, the website that's run by Kiki and others, facets, we have a table outside. So we have some materials right outside the store, so feel free to check it out.